This is the extended version of New Classical Tracks with film composer Stephen Edwards as he talks more about his new recording, Requiem for My Mother, and the documentary that accompanies it. I hope you enjoy it. Stephen, for those who may not be familiar with you or your work, how do you describe yourself when you introduce yourself to somebody?
I describe myself as a film composer, and my life is very eclectic. I do a lot of different things. My schedule is different every single day, so one day I might be doing a song for a film. The next day I might be scoring a film. I just finished a movie called Dead Trigger, which is a zombie movie with an extremely high body count. And it's kind of futuristic, and it, you know, lots of peril and disease and death and mayhem. And so I wrote, probably 65 minutes of original score for that. So it was quite involved. I literally finished Sunday morning. So it keeps me quite busy. So my world is very eclectic. I'm doing commercials. I'm doing film scores. I work on TV shows. I do a lot of songwriting. And then occasionally I get to go work in the classical world.
So tell me how this has evolved, how your career has evolved, because that's a lot of different stuff.
It is.
And you probably had to start somewhere. And how did you kind of figure out that, you know, these were the areas you wanted to dabble in?
Well, I started out as a player, as a piano player. And my first job, I went to college in northern Wisconsin at this little conservatory called Lawrence University. And when I was there, I auditioned and did a national talent search at Disney for the All-American College Orchestra, and I won the piano chair. So I moved to Orlando, Florida, and I did this live show every day with all my colleagues, all my kids that were my age. And I met a couple of Hollywood film people there, including one called Mike Post. And Mike invited me to live in L.A. and work for him. So I basically took my car and moved out there and started being a session player. But I learned very quickly that I wanted to be literally the person on the other side of the glass. I wanted to be the guy that was writing the music, not the guy that was hired to play the music for someone else. So in the 90s, I got my first job scoring a film. And that's kind of I just kind of met the people and networked and figured out a way to get into that world. It's, you know, it's a very closed world. It's very difficult to get in, as you can imagine.
So when we're talking about film music, are you watching the film while you write the music? Is that how that works?
Absolutely. Unless it's a song or something that's a pre-record, I'm writing to the visuals. So I get a scene that's a minute long, and at 20 seconds, a guy comes around the corner with a knife, and then at 40 seconds, they cut to a scene where a guy is professing his love for his girlfriend. You know, so the music changes in linear time to the visuals. So my job is to comment on and make the visuals look like that's the only way they could be cut by writing a piece of music that matches what I see visually.
So is there a film for which you've written music that is especially memorable for you, that is just like, wow, this is the film I want you to remember me for in terms of the score or the song that you wrote?
That's such a good question. There's so many. I think maybe I could do that by genre, because I've done so many different genres. I did one, I did a Rin Tin Tin movie that my kids, when they were little, used to love. It's like the original story of the dog in 1920 that was discovered in a German bunker by American soldiers in World War I. And when the dog was adopted, and then they brought Rin Tin Tin over here, and of course, you know, they had series and they had movies, and now his descendants of many generations are Rin Tin Tin dogs in the United States. So that's a fun one. So many. I can't even begin to tell you. I've done 60 features, so it's been a very busy world. But
wow. Well, I was trying to think of some that I could use as a way of introducing you.
Yeah.
That people would go, oh, yeah, I've seen that. Like the Dallas Buyers Club is one that really struck me.
I've had my fill, had it up to here. I'm sick of this mess, gonna get it in gear. I wanna hit the road and get on with my life. I wanna hit the road.
I think the arrangement-wise, probably the coolest thing I ever did was there's a TV show called Transparent that's on Amazon that's gotten a lot of attention. And I did this giant sort of eclectic, crazy wedding band arrangement for this very pivotal scene. I think it was season 2. actually was on the set with them, and I picked the band, handpicked the band, and they sort of gave me this list of songs, and they said, just run with it, do the arrangement. And we ended up shooting for about 7 hours in a big ballroom with 50 people in white tuxedos. It was one of the craziest, coolest shoots I've ever been a part of. So, I mean, there's like a lot of memorable things I do just kind of as my normal day-to-day, you know?
I know you have a 15-year-old daughter. What does she think of this zombie film that you've just written? Is she a zombie fan?
She's a huge Walking Dead fan. Huge. Like, that's one of her shows. Both of my daughters. I have also a 19-year-old. And so when I told them I was doing a zombie movie, they were very suspicious because they thought it was going to be bad compared to the Walking Dead, which they are in love with. So they haven't seen the final because, I mean, I literally just delivered the music this week. So we'll see what they think about it. But it's kind of a send-off of Walking Dead. And if you have to watch the movie to sort of understand that, the way it's structured. But it was a lot of fun.
So what have you done in your career that has given you cred with your daughters?
Ooh, that's a good question. The cred with my daughters, like the hip factor. I think the first time, I'll tell you what happened, there was a show called Hannah Montana, which was a huge Disney show, Miley Cyrus. And I was literally with my daughters at a neighbor's house, and we were watching the show, you know, eating their lunch. And one of my songs came on the show. They had licensed the song because I have a representative that does it. I wasn't informed about it until after I saw this airing. And when my song was associated with Miley Cyrus, my stock went up many points instantaneously because they knew the song. They'd heard me working on it. And then now that it's associated, now it's on TV. Like, I'm not trying to like force it. I'm like, hey, that's my song. It was one of those moments where like, hey, this guy's okay. He's not just dad anymore. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that is so cool. Yeah, I feel neat. Like my daughter is, you know, the same thing.
Exactly.
And it was like being on the radio is like, oh, that's no big deal.
Exactly.
You know, who cares about that? Until they realized it was to their advantage in some way.
Exactly.
To tell people, oh, I was on the radio.
Yeah.
She does that. She interviews cool people.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. Let's talk a little bit about the role that your mother played in your life, because your most recent work is A Requiem for My Mother that also became a public television special. Tell me a little bit about your mom.
So my mom was a very talented musician in her own right. She was a flutist and a piano player, and she graduated from the University of Michigan in the 50s and became a private piano, flute, and voice teacher. And then she started teaching in high schools. And then she started teaching at the University of Michigan, where she resurrected the Women's Glee Club, which to this day is still going. So when I was a kid, when I was 6 or 7 years old, there's a Steinway piano in my living room. And the kids, part of the deal, there's four of us, part of the deal was, hey, you're taking music lessons. What do you want to play? What instrument? It wasn't whether, it was what. So, you know, I was playing hockey because my dad was influencing the sports. But my mom said, okay, you know, choose your music instrument, let's go. So I started playing piano when I was 7, and she was the main force behind my music. She was the biggest influence. She was my biggest cheerleader. She was, you know, literally gave me the gift of life and the gift of music.
And there are photos of you performing with your mother.
Yeah, there are.
Tell me about those experiences.
Well, we did a lot. Like, there's actually a Super 8 movie of me playing the gangster in Kiss Me, Kate, singing Brush Up Your Shakespeare while she's conducting the student orchestra that she wrangled and basically rehearsed them and got them, you know. So when I was in high school, she was the music teacher in my high school. And then, you know, we did some stuff together. Even when I got married, you know, we did a four-hand piano duet. So there was kind of always this presence of music, and we'd call each other and say, have you heard this new singer? She's unbelievable. And we'd go to concerts together. We had a very simpatico relationship in terms of how we enjoyed music and how we appreciated it and how we consumed it.
So how did she feel when you decided to make this your career?
She was pretty excited about it because there was this sort of this vicarious, like, wow, you can make money writing music. And she never really pursued that. I think she kind of in her in her fantasy world wanted to be a jingle writer, and she had a very good, very keen ear, and she could write tunes. She actually wrote the tune for the Women's Glee Club that was called Women of Michigan, which we actually feature in the documentary a little bit. And my uncle was a very fine pianist, trained at Juilliard, and he could really play. And my uncle wrote a song in the 1950s called Little Sandy Slayfoot that was actually recorded by this guy called Jimmy Dean the Sausage King.
His name was Sandy Slayfoot, and oh so sad was he. For though he stood just 4 feet tall, his feet were 3 foot three.
That was on the radio. It actually was like a minor novelty hit. So when I was a little kid, they gave me this Columbia Records 45 with his name on it. And I was like, wow, how cool is that? It's my uncle, and he wrote this song. Like, how am I would love to do that someday. Like, I'm living in Ann Arbor, Michigan. I have no idea what that meant or how to go about it. But yeah, I look at it like, wow, he did something that, you know, got on the national stage. It was a huge moment for me when I saw that. Like, okay, if he can do it, maybe I can do it someday. I don't know.
That's interesting because you grew up in Ann Arbor.
Mm-hmm, I did.
Where there's an amazing music school, yet you chose to go to a smaller conservatory.
I did.
How did you make that decision?
Because I wanted to do a lot of different things. So I went to Lawrence. I was on the basketball team. I was in a fraternity. I was in the conservatory of music. So I double majored. I got a Bachelor of Music and Piano Performance and a minor in economics in 5 years. And it's one of the only schools in the country where you can actually get 2 degrees at the same time. So I just kind of thought, well, if I go to a conservatory, I got into Indiana Conservatory, I'm going to be living in that world and pigeonholed in that world. And it's interesting, like now I am in the music business. Like I'm doing those two things. And my father was a businessman and my mother was a musician. So it's like, you don't have to look very hard to see how I got where I am today, because that's who my parents were. My father was a successful businessman and my mom was a successful musician. And like, okay, I just had to look no further than my parents to see where, you know, where that was going to come from for me. Mm-hmm. So
So I want to transition into talking a little bit about what inspired you to write this Requiem for your mother.
Well, it was her death. So she died in 2006. And actually, if you back up, what I was originally going to do, Pope John Paul II died in 2005, and he was such an inspirational figure for all of us. And my parents actually went to a private audience with him in Vatican City, so I kind of paid attention to him, and I thought he was an inspirational character. And I actually sang for him when he came to L.A. I sang in a choir with this famous conductor called Paul Salomonovich, and Paul got invited to sing the papal mass at this small church. And so there he was, and there I was singing for him. I was like, wow, this guy he was such a powerhouse. And so when he passed away in 2005, I was like, wow, this would be really interesting to write a requiem in his honor. So I started formulating the idea, and there's a conductor I work with in New Jersey called Candace Wickey. She has an organization called Continual Arts. And Continual Arts does concerts in Carnegie Hall, and they also do concerts in Vatican City. So I sort of threw the idea out of like, hey, what about a requiem for John Paul? And she's like, that's interesting. You know, there's a lot of steps that you have to do. And as soon as we sort of started kicking it around a little bit, my mom got sick and she died very quickly from cancer. So when that happened, it was kind of obvious to me like, oh, okay, you know, I'm going to write it for Rosie, for my mom, because that was such the, you know, it was such a body blow to lose my mother. I made it into my 40s without ever losing anybody. And my father died 5 months later. So it was just like this, you know, it was this very heavy emotional, I'd never gone down that road emotionally before. So where I went was to the music. That was my only place to turn, you know.
So I'm thinking about composing a requiem versus writing songs for films, mm-hmm. or, you know, film scores. How did you make that transition? Or maybe it was easier than I'm thinking.
Well, it's interesting. There's a lot of parallels. So you're right. Because when I write for film, I'm writing to a fixed image with timings. And the only thing I had to write the requiem was the text. And I made a decision. The first decision I made was it has to be in Latin. Because the Latin language is just so cool. It's so cosmic. It's a dead language. It just has a certain sound that if this requiem was written in English, I don't think anybody would care. It would just sound so contrived to me. I don't know. There's something so spiritual or something about using that language, and the same language that Mozart wrote in, Verdi, Brahms, Durafle, all the famous requiems were written in Latin. So that was the first thing. So what I had was a text. I had the words. So I I made a decision what the words were. I was going to use the words that had been there for over 1,000 years, and I wasn't going to change them. So that was the first thing. And then really what it is I just sat down and wrote tunes to the lyric, essentially. So somebody else provided me the lyric, and then I just sat down at the piano and started writing tunes. And then, of course, it's fleshed out full. You know, it's a 50-piece orchestra. There's a 60-voice children's choir, and there's an SATB chorus, sopranos, altos, tenors, basses, and 3 soloists, soprano, tenor, baritone. So there was a lot of – it's a musical traffic jam. You know, there's a lot of people here. But it started out as a very simple, you know, me writing on a sketch pad at the piano, writing tunes, and then maybe writing a counterpoint line, and then writing, you know, it's like writing a book. You have a chapter heading, and then you say, okay, the character is going to do this in this scene, and then I'm going to flesh it out this way. And you just sort of pull that string, and suddenly you've got this, you know, giant score that's, you know, 150 pages long, and it takes 50 minutes to perform it.
Now, I want to talk about the big production that it became at the premiere, but first let's talk about some of the individual movements within the Requiem. And I made a few notes, but do you have like a favorite part, or is that too hard to do when you've got 11 different elements here?
There's some favorite moments that I had writing it. The first one was coming up with a tune for the very first movement called Requiem Aeternum, because one of the first decisions I made was there's going to be a children's chorus as part of this piece, which I don't think has ever been done. I'm trying to think if there's another Requiem with a children's chorus, and maybe there is. Now, that's a certain noise. There's a certain sound that children make when they sing that's just, it's just unique. It's got its own. There's an innocence. There's a hope. It's just got something that adults can't bring to the party when they sing. So sitting at the piano, knowing that the first tune was going to be children, this whole tune kind of fell out of me. And when that fell out, that was a very seminal piece of 24 bars of music that ended up being a lot of connective tissue for the rest of the work. That was a favorite moment. And then the Dies Irae, which is sort of one of the more dynamic movements, and that text is just so, like, bombastic. If there's a more fire and brimstone text, I don't know it. It's like death and wrath and the devil taking over the world. I mean, it is just... I mean, if I can't be inspired by that text, I should go be a plumber, you know what I mean? Because it's just so much in there. So the Dies Irae was a huge battle, because the Verdi Dies Irae and the Mozart Dies Irae are just so iconically famous. I mean, you watch a movie trailer for this new movie called House with Will Ferrell. They use the Verdi Dies Irae as the trailer music. So we've all heard it a million times, you know, Mozart Amadeus. I mean, it's one of those things that's just, I couldn't write a Dies Irae because it was just rattling around in my brain, and I was literally losing my mind. So I would just punt. I would leave it, and then I would go write another movement and call Candace, my conductor, who was collaborating with him, and saying, you know, sorry, dude, you know, nothing came out today, so I'm going to just have to, you know, I have to just default to something else. And finally, there was this sort of eureka moment where I was sitting at the piano one day, and I was just sort of, you know, fooling around, and this sort of multi-metric Dies Irae thing came out. And once I had this 8-bar little cell, it just wrote itself. Had a lot of moments like that that were like, once I just sort of squeezed out these ideas, then the rest of it just flowed.
I also thought that the Sanctus was especially beautiful, and maybe that has something to do with that sense of innocence and purity from the children's choir.
Exactly.
Again.
And if it's not sung by the children, it's a different deal. I'm not even sure you would be saying that. There's something about the kids, and it's interesting because, you know, there's about 8 choirs that went to Rome, to Vatican City, to perform this piece And so the choirs were from all over. There's some from Wisconsin, from Madison. There was some from Florida. There's some from New York, and there's some from New Jersey. So we put this big group of choirs together, and they had to rehearse in their cities. They had to learn the music. They're not professional choirs. They're like church choirs, and they're, you know, people that love to sing. And so they learned the music, and then we threw everybody together in Rome, and we had 2 days or 3 days maybe to rehearse. But one of the things we did is we went into a studio in Rome and made this recording that you have, because we had everybody. It was the only time we had everybody together. And it was the studio was started by Maestro Ennio Morricone, who is maybe my favorite film composer, my top two or three. And it's based in Rome. That's where he's based. He's spent his whole career there. So they recorded The Mission there and Cinema Paradiso and some of my all-time favorite scores. And so we put these kids. The kids came and sang their parts, and they had the whole thing memorized. No charts at all. And by the way, the adults were, you know, looking at scores. The kids had the whole thing memorized. So the kids really carried that ball.
And they're fearless.
Fearless.
I mean, I even remember being a kid singing, yeah. And it was like, oh, yeah, I just know that. You sing it enough. You're always kind of singing something in your head once you start to learn it, whereas an adult, there's more of a fear factor
exactly.
there. I might mess up.
Exactly. And kids just... The kids are so, just so crucially huge in this thing. And, you know, we had 8-year-olds. It was like 8 to 15, 14, 15, maybe 16. So, you know, the kids had to come with their parents. You know, we're going to Rome. I mean, this is not like you're going downtown to church. This is like a, you know, a major trip. So, you know, there was about 300 of us that flew over there.
Now, tell me about the video that many saw on Mother's Day this year on public television.
So Requiem for My Mother is a feature-length documentary film. And the short version is I'm the co-director of the film with David Haugland. And when we went to Rome, we took a camera crew with us, and we shot all of the rehearsals, and we shot the performance. And then there's all this backstory about me and my relationship with Rosie. So there's film of me relating about what happened with my mom when she died. And there's film of the rehearsals. And then there's film of the performance. And there's this whole thing like, well, how are we going to pull this thing off? Because first of all, we got to get everybody over there. And then we got to throw everybody together. And then also, by the way, the orchestra was from Prague, because I've done a lot of movies with the Prague Symphony. And since I'd had such a nice collaboration with them, I called the contractor and I said, hey, you want to come to Rome? He's like, okay. So they figured out, you know, we flew them down there. We had to raise the money and have to pay them, of course. And they put them up in a hotel, and you know, they had to rehearse the music too. So Candace recorded the Prague Symphony in Prague. She recorded their stems first. And then when we recorded in Rome, the orchestra sang to the backing tracks that the Prague orchestra provided for us. So this production had so many moving parts.
So the orchestra was not there with the choir when you did the premiere in Rome?
No, the orchestra was with
us. Okay, okay.
But the recording we did in Prague before we flew. Because we didn't have any days. We needed a whole day to record the orchestra. So she did that before. She just did a special flight over there, came back, and then we had 2 solid full days with the choirs singing to the backing tracks.
Now, why was it important to do this in Rome?
Well, we got invited. So Candace got invited by Musica Sacra, which is a very prestigious festival in Vatican City. And she was the first woman conductor ever invited. And I was the first American composer ever invited to present over there, which is kind of amazing. So when she got invited, she invited me. They just basically said, Candace, you know, you come and perform something. And I think they just figured they were going to do, you know, Mozart Requiem, Verdi Requiem. I mean, you know, there's a list of 10 classical works that everybody knows that she would just do. And she said, well, let's do the Edwards Requiem. And they're like, who? Who's that? Like, they've never heard it. They don't know who I am. Interestingly, I'm a citizen of Italy, so I had a little street cred with them. We'll talk about that later. But anyway, so we had to send CDs of an earlier... We'd done a performance of part of it in Carnegie Hall. I'd only written half of it at that time. It's kind of a long story, but we wrote the rest of it. I wrote the rest of it for Rome, but we had to send CDs to a jury in Rome, and they listened to it, and then they approved it, and then... She extended the invitation to me. So there's a little, you know, they don't want something on that program that they're not going to approve of, basically.
Okay, so how is it you're an Italian citizen?
So my mother, Rosie, was 100% Sicilian. And after she passed away, a friend of mine told me that he was a citizen of Italy. I was like, you're not, you know, your name's Smith. What are you talking about? How can you be a citizen of Italy? Well, his mother was just like me, Italian. And the Italian government has a rule that says if you're born in the States, but your mother's parents didn't naturalize until after your mother was born, which was mine, which was true with me, I could be a citizen by way both of my daughters are citizens. So I had to go through this whole, it took 2.5 years, and now I have a red passport. It's pretty neat.
So was there ever a moment when this was all coming together in Rome where you had doubts like, oh my gosh, what were we thinking?
Oh gosh, yeah. Because, well, basically the day of the performance, that's the only day that the orchestra and the choir got to sing together, got to rehearse together. So the choir was rehearsed, and now a lot of these singers had never even heard the orchestra before. And remember, these aren't professional singers, except for our soloists. The choirs are amateur choirs, and they're being asked to go on the world stage. You know, so Candace kept saying, hey, you know what, guys? You're going on the world stage. If you're not ready, you're going to be asked to not perform. So there was a little bit at stake there. Now, of course, they just slayed it. They did so well. But I was just thinking, you know, I had 20 family members there, both my brothers and my sister, and all the kids flew over. So, you know, it was like, you're exposed. You're, you know, I don't know. I don't know what's going to happen. And, you know, Vatican TV was there. Vatican TV broadcast the concert, and Vatican Radio broadcast the concert. So once we got into it, once they started the performance, it was like, okay, this is going great. And, you know, they did so well.
Is there an especially memorable moment during that performance that you can recall?
Yeah, there was, and it's actually on film. My daughter, who was, let's see, how old would she have been at the time? 7? Sat in my lap. And so they had these, like, it was amazing. Like, it's Rome, because Rome does everything in a certain formal way. And for myself and a couple of the cardinals that were in attendance, they had these giant, like, red throne chairs with velvet. They were like, 3 times as big as the chair I'm sitting in. And one of them was for me. And so I sat there, and then my wife sat back, and all my family kind of sat behind, and my daughter just kind of crept up, and she sat up on my lap. That was cool. And they're not going to kick her off at that point, but that was neat. So if you watch the film, you can see towards the end, she's sitting on my lap, and, you know, we're both watching, and I'm like, okay, this is, you know, it's going well. But that was neat. It's a neat memory. Yeah,
very, very special. So the documentary, now, was this out before this year?
It just premiered May 14th, Mother's Day.
Okay, even though it was literally made over, like, 8 years ago.
Oh, well, we just finished it.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, this
Thank
is a long, yeah, this is a long process.
Got it.
Yeah, we had
Got
100
it.
Hours of footage.
All right, let's see. We talked about some of the movements. Is there any other movement you want to talk about in particular?
Well, the Agnus Dei is interesting because it's a cappella. And so when we were formulating the idea from the beginning, Candace said, you know, let's do a movement where the choir could just be featured. So there's that. And then the kids kind of keep kicking back the theme. If you listen to the whole thing, you'll hear this sort of the theme that you hear from the very first, done in different contexts. And then towards the end of the piece, the adults take the theme. Talking about music is like, it's almost absurd. I'm talking about this, like, what is the quote from Laurie Anderson? Talking about music is like trying to dance architecture. Like, I'm talking about it. You know what I'm saying? Like, we could talk about what happened, but you kind of have to listen to the music to know.
Well, this music is all going to be under you while you're talking about it.
Oh, excellent.
Yeah. So you don't have to. Okay. You're describing it, but they'll be hearing it.
Great.
So don't worry about that.
Good.
So the better you describe it, the better this will all come together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last movement is called In Paradisum. And so the text takes you through all these moments. Like, there's a lot of fire and brimstone. And then it's kind of like the recommended terms, like rest in peace and, you know. And then the last movement is In Paradisum, and may your soul rest in heaven. It's kind of like, it's like wishing someone well, sending them off. And the In Paradisum starts with the children a cappella by themselves. And there's this huge climax at the end of it. And then the kids sort of run with it again, and they finish the Requiem by themselves. So they bookend the Requiem. A lot of the favorites have been the last movement, the first movement, and the Dies Irae has been kind of, like, if you look on iTunes, you can tell how many times people listen, and those have been the three that people just sort of gravitate towards.
Yeah, I made a note, especially about the last movement, In Paradisum, and that's also because the orchestra sounds amazing, by the way. I mean, oh my gosh, they are crystal clear, and the horns really soar throughout, especially in that movement.
Thank you. I gave them something to do. That's what I wanted to, like, this orchestra I'd worked with quite a bit. I did a horror movie called Feast with them, where they were literally, I mean, I just took them through the course. You know, I wrote horror music. And in this one, I was like, I want them to sound as, you know, as beautiful and lyrical and expressive as I possibly know how to do. And, you know, Rosie was a good flute player, so the flutist has quite a role in this. She has a long Czech name. I'm not going to remember her name, but she's fabulous. So I gave her a lot of solos just because it was easy to sort of pick the flute as the instrument that would be playing some of these tunes because of Rosie.
Looks like Andrea Pazdarova, something
like
that.
There you go. That's
maybe
pretty good. Yeah. Yeah, that's good.
So my final question, I get the sense that you didn't write this Requiem just for your mother.
Well, that's an interesting way of putting it. I did write it just for my mother, but what I found was as soon as I gave it away, it was for other people. And like, for example, the closest association was Candace's brother died suddenly at like 39 years old of a heart attack right when I first met her. And so it kind of became referential for her. And then I kept getting these stories. I'm getting letters right now. So the CD right now is number 6 on the Billboard charts, which we're pretty excited about, the classical charts. And so I'm getting letters from people like, oh, you know, I'm listening to this and, you know, my great aunt passed away and, you know, I love having this as a tribute for her. So I'm getting a lot of that. But when I first wrote it, it wasn't that. But what I realized, I learned very quickly after I wrote it was it's really not for me, and it's really not for just my mom. It's to give away. It's to offer up to others, which has been really gratifying.
I love how you say that, to give it away. It's like a form of gratitude.
It
almost is.
It's thank you for the music and thank you for my life. Like, you know, what else am I going to do? Like, this is a tribute for my mom, but, you know, and it's kind of a big deal, but really it's not. It's a small thing for someone who gave me so much for, you know, my whole entire life. It's a tiny little thing. You know, to me, the piece is kind of like a call to action. Like, you know, maybe you're not going to sit down and write a requiem for your mom. I actually don't recommend it because it's not for the faint-hearted. But, you know, dedicate a park bench, endow a scholarship, you know, do something for someone that you love. It's sort of a call to action to do something. That's what I felt like. I felt like I had to do something for someone that was just so important and to this day still is important, even though she's not here anymore.
And I guess that's what they mean by the afterlife. It's up to us to make sure that they have a life after.
And she does. I mean, and just by sharing this story, I think people are inspired by it, and that's what, you know, they're moved by it. And what else can I ask for?
And that's the extended version of New Classical Tracks, this week featuring film composer Stephen Edwards, with special thanks going out to producer Valerie Kaler. I'm Julia Mocker from American Public Media.